Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
Hello, and welcome back to the Rogue Startups Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Hewitt. This episode, I'm joined by Rob Walling. I think most folks who listen to this podcast know of Rob from his own podcast, Startups for the Rest of Us. Rob's also the former founder of Drip, popular email marketing automation platform, and now runs the Tiny Seed Accelerator program. Rob and I have podcasted quite a bit, as I mentioned in this episode, either on Startups for the Rest of Us or in the Tiny Seed Tales series that he kind of featured Castos evolution through the batch one of the Tiny Seed program. In this episode, I chat with Rob a bit about kind of what's going on and what's new with Tiny Seed. They're in their second batch and second year of the program now. And like all of us, I think Rob is learning as he's going about what's working, what's not, what things to look for in companies and what things are really working for those companies. And now he's kind of seeing two of those cohorts. So he's seen batch one, now he's starting to see batch two. And particularly in the end of this episode, we dig into the things that he's seeing consistently between batch one and batch two companies that is providing for this really kind of hyper growth scenario. So stay tuned for that right towards the end of the episode. We also talk through a bit of a mental exercise of what if Rob hadn't sold Drip? So, you know, Drip was a really popular email marketing platform, and Rob exited it 4 years ago. I didn't know it's been that long. And for those of you who have listened to the podcast for a while, you know that I'm kind of fascinated with this question of like sell or don't sell or lifestyle business or take funding. And all these questions, I think, are questions we should always be asking ourselves of like, what do I need and what does my business need right now and why? And so Rob obviously sold Drip 4 years ago. But in this episode, I wanted to ask him, like, what if he didn't sell Drip? What would his options have looked like? And how would he have navigated from the point he was at, which was, you know, a fast-growing, self-funded SaaS company, to getting to where it was a sustainable kind of situation for him and his lifestyle and the business? And I think the options there are to take funding or to scale back growth maybe and make it more of a quote lifestyle business. And I don't think any of us should think that has a negative connotation, because I think there's a lot to be said for running a business for a very long time. But Rob and I talk through a lot of that in this episode as well. And he has some really interesting insights. So I think we can all learn some of the general lessons that can be applied to us and our businesses and our situations from what he's been through and kind of seeing this in hindsight 4 years later. Hope you enjoy this episode with Rob Walling. So Rob, it's been a while since you've been on the podcast, but you and I podcast a lot. I feel like I'm on a lot of podcasts, or we're on a lot of podcasts together, but it's nice to catch up here. How are things going for you guys?
Oh, in general, they're pretty good, man. It's nice to chat with you again. We haven't talked in a few weeks. But yeah, the COVID kind of quarantine stuff has eased up. We're in phase three, which for, you know, Minnesota means everything is open in essence. Like the restaurants are open, but it's at reduced capacity and you have to wear a mask unless you're eating. And even like gyms are open, but they have pretty stringent requirements. And a lot of businesses are choosing to stay closed still, you know, to kind of see what happens. We have not had a flare up here in Minneapolis, you know, knock on wood to date. I know that there are other places around the country and I was going to say around the world, but mostly just around the United States that are...
It's just Florida. You can say it, man. Being a Florida native, it's okay.
Isn't it Arizona? I mean, there's just some places that really are having some struggles still, you know, so...
Yeah, I mean, so for reference, we're recording this kind of towards the end of June. So yeah, I mean, it's scary to watch on the news. My folks still live in Orlando and they're pretty much back in lockdown now. So it's like, for me always, like through all this, that was the thing. As I said, if people have to go back in lockdown after getting out, they're going to be
tough.
I mean, riots, literal riots. And I don't know that we're there yet, but yeah.
Well, things are going much better for you over in France, right? You were telling me your people's kids are back in school and it sounds like everything's
wide
open.
Yeah, man, we're having pretty much everything is, you know, quote, normal. I feel like the shit we went through in the quarantine is worth it now because we're on the other side for the moment. Who knows what'll happen? But yeah, for the moment, it seems like the quarantine was worth it to get the, you know, the freedoms that we have now. Yeah.
Very cool.
you know, I think I was talking privately to somebody, but I'll share on the podcast because people ask me a lot about Tiny Seed and what the experience was like. And it's been weird to not be in Tiny Seed anymore. Just a couple of weeks now that we've kind of wrapped up our the first cohort's year. And I'm having a bit of withdrawal from like the connectedness that we had within the group. So it's kind of interesting. But I think a lot of people that listen to this show are interested in kind of what's going on with Tiny Seed. I know you talk about it on Startups for the Rest of Us a fair bit. But I would love to hear, you know, how things are going with Batch 2 and kind of how you and Einar and Tracy are feeling about everything. Like, yeah, just love to hear kind of the latest.
For sure. And Craig, you and Caspus will always be part of Tiny Seed. Maybe you just won't be in an active batch, right?
For better or worse.
Yeah. So you're in Slack and you're an alum and you're, you know, I know that folks in batch one are still connected and interacting a bit, even if, you know, there were some mastermind groups that formed and others are probably won't stay together. But, and then I think that it's been really invaluable to be able to pull, I'm not sure this occurred to me at the start, but it's been valuable for as batch two companies come in to be able to say, oh, you need help with that? Well, yes, we do have a mentor, but we also have a batch one founder who did exactly this 8 months ago. Mm. So I'm going to give you what I told them, you know, because there was like an example is like hiring a customer success person, like your first customer success person. And so I had done a brain dump for someone in batch one. They went off, they hired successfully. They now have a job description. They have their process that they took mine from 2015 maybe 2014 I did a drip and improved it. You know, it's more modernized and just a better thing. So started with me, was improved, and now a batch two member is basically able to get advice, you know, about how to do something better. So that's been kind of a cool, I think, side effect of it. And that, of course, you know, we always hear about the YC alums and how there's a huge network there. See, I went to public school. Like, I went to public school all the way through college. And so being an alum was never a thing for me, but now I'm starting to realize the value of, you know, of going to one of the, like an Ivy League school or something. I think when I was 18, no one in my family, aside from my brother directly older than me, had ever graduated from college, extended family, my parents, anything. And so I just kind of went to a college that was close to home and was not super expensive, but now realizing, oh yeah, you graduate from Harvard or Stanford, like the cohort that you're in there, I finally get that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, especially graduate school. Like, I think, you know, that place you get the last level before you get placed, I think is really where that network comes in. Yeah. Business school or master's programs or whatever. Yeah.
And like I was saying, you know, and you totally see that, hear about that in Y Combinator. And now I see, oh yeah, that's going to be a thing with Tiny Seed. Like the batches, you know, the alums and the network of being, you know, saying, oh, as part of Tiny Seed batch one or batch five or whatever, I think is going to be a big thing.
Well, I'd love to hear how things are going with the second batch and you know, as much as you can share about kind of what you guys have learned or maybe are doing different this time around.
Yeah, absolutely. So the second batch was interesting in that the application process was a lot. We improved it. We improved like the mechanics of it because the first one was very much an MVP, a no code slapped together MVP that was pretty brittle, I'll say. And it was like a Google spreadsheet with it. You know, it was hard to sift through and hard to rate and do all that. And so we had Tracy research and try to, for those who don't know, Tracy's our program manager for the accelerator. And she researched and found a tool that helps with that. So that alone made it a lot more efficient for us. So we started improving our processes. That was cool. The second thing was we really didn't have to bang the drum as hard to get we got more quality or more companies that were higher quality, further along, more traction, you know, just more, I'll say a better fit, more investable probably is an interesting way to say it. I think it depends on how you count, but around twice as many companies from about give or take the same number of applicants. So it was a very interesting thing. And I think that's one part of we honed our messaging a bit. You know, we kind of learned with the first run of like, oh, well, we need, you know, we're really not investing in like direct to consumer or physical product. Like, let's explicitly, we never said we would, but we had a lot of those in the first batch application. And we honed it. We kept saying, all right, now it really is SaaS. It's mostly B2B SaaS, you know, and kind of got that down. And I also think there's a kind of like building a brand, right? It's like you do something once and some people are like, oh, can this work? Will this work? What will the results be? And then you do it once successfully and more people are interested in it. I actually made the analogy to launching MicroConf in 2011, where we couldn't sell enough tickets. We barely sold enough to break even and didn't fill the room. But it was the event itself proved itself so well that first year and had so much buzz that we sold the second event out. It was about not twice as much, but it was a larger event. We sold that out in 2 weeks. And the third year we did MicroConf, we sold it out in 24 hours. And the fourth year we did it, we sold it out in 6 minutes. And there was no additional effort. You know what I mean? It was still just an email list and we sent an email and you build this momentum and this brand and this, you know, I think this headspace that people, it's a trust, right? Of like, oh, this works. And this is something I want to be part of.
I wanted to shift the episode to kind of a, I don't know, maybe it's a hypothetical question, but I think there's a lot of practical mindset and kind of strategic things that we can pull out of this. And the email that I sent to you a few weeks ago was, hey, Rob, I would love to do an episode that was, what if I didn't sell drip? And the idea here is your kind of life and career would have taken a really different trajectory if you would have kind of kept the company and grown it. And I think that like what, where you would be today maybe is not as interesting as like, I would love to start around the time when you entertained the idea of like selling the business and kind of like what things looked like and why you thought, you know, raising money or selling the business or something like that was maybe a good move. Like, I think that's a good place to start because I think, and this is a really long preamble to this question, but I think that the thing that kind of triggered this in my mind was the episode that you and Jordan did recently talking about when you get past this traction and like growth to like breakout growth, like when you get into that phase, it seems like, and we're not there, but it seems like a lot of things change in your business with how you operate and how you grow. And I guess that's the start question is like, is that like being in that phase of the business, is that really what kind of brought some of this decision to do something different with the business on?
Yeah, I think it did. Because as the business changes, you just have to constantly be evaluating, you know, what does the business need now? And I'm actually pulling up, I forget what I named all the stages, but I'm pulling that up now. Yeah, I guess stage four was like escape velocity, and that was from about 20K of MRR up to like 83,000 of MRR. Mm. And then scale was around 80 to 200K. And it's a give or take. I mean, Jordan and I were, you know, these are loose numbers. It depends on how fast you grow and all that. And then company building, we put after, you know, about 200K MRR. And at each of those stages, you just need something so different. And with Drip, when we hit around, like, so Drip was funded with revenue that I was pulling out, or profit I was pulling out of Hittail. And I wound up putting about 150 to 200K into the business because it was just so competitive to get it started. I bootstrapped all the stuff, but a lot of the business I had started earlier, I'd started with so much less funding. And this, in essence, was, you know, self-funding Drip in a really hyper-competitive space. But we hit a point pretty quick, and it was in the 30, 40, 50K MRR range where growth started accelerating faster and faster. And we were pretty severely hampered by money. Like, more funds would have been able to allow us to probably hire faster was probably the number one thing, because I was hiring quite slow. I was hiring to revenue, you know, because once we hit break even, I was like, man, I don't want to dig back into my personal savings to fund this more. And I want, this is a viable business. It's obviously successful, but it was tough. And like one of the, you know, some of the hard parts are like, you can only hire junior people because I didn't have the patience to wait 3 months to have enough money to hire a senior, whatever. So I would wait two months of growth and then I'd hire like a junior to mid-level, but then we'd have to kind of train them up. And so there was that. And there was, I'm trying to even think, like Amazon servers, we could have, you know, our hosting bill, I had to pay way too close attention to that. And we had a ton of competition and people were growing quickly. It was even like ad spend. Like, I couldn't spend as much on ads or on marketing as I would have liked because we just didn't have that leeway.
So you guys were, you know, at this kind of $1 million ARR, give or take, right? And even then it was not enough to kind of fuel the resources that you needed in the business to continue like growing on that path. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it was enough. Like, we were growing fast, and we would have continued. It was, we'd grow for a month or two, and then we'd hire and go back to break even. We'd grow for a month or two, three, hire, break even. And I was like, man, I could really use like three or four hires right now to scale this thing up. Or I could really use, the funds. I'll tell you the other thing. I mean, it's related, but I didn't hire, we were at like 10 people when we got acquired. I didn't hire any like internal, like non-revenue focused people. And like developers, I consider they're building the product that's going to generate revenue, customer success, sales, all that's going to generate revenue, and support is going to keep customers around, which, you know, these aren't direct revenue connection, but they're all product-based things. We had no internal, we had no HR ops, you know, office manager is what they used to be called. And so I was doing all of that. And that's the other thing is that was kind of it was a mistake, but I knew it at the time, but I felt like I don't want to spend the time right now to hire someone and the money on this role when I really want another developer, or I really want another customer success salesperson that will generate more money, and then I'll fix this later. And it took a toll on me as a result, because I wound up doing, I don't know if you've seen Jason Cohen's talk on, he had a talk about burnout, but he's like, you know, as founders, we can do a ton of things. You know, there's this big circle, but like a bunch of these you don't like to do, and they will lead to burnout. You know, so you have to Venn diagram that thing of like, what do you actually like to do? You know, and then, and that's where I found myself, was like, this isn't as fun as the past businesses I've built, you know, and it's growing really fast and this should be exciting, but it's actually very draining. And I find myself being tired and depressed all the time.
Mm, interesting. I know you've said before, like that you never like regretted selling. Do you, and the answer, I guess, kind of has to be yes, but do you ever think about that in the lens of if you would have kind of managed the growth of the business and the people on the team to where you didn't burn out, that your considerations around selling would have been different?
You know, I've thought about it a little bit. There were more factors. The answer is, I'm not sure. There were more
factors.
Yeah, it's
tough to know, right?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, there were more factors than just, oh, I'm burned out, I need to sell the business. It really was, I felt under-diversified. I had worked since 2000 and really about two. So yeah, I'll put dates into perspective. This was like 15 years into my career, and I had pumped every extra consulting dollar, everything that was not in our house or in our cars was in all these businesses. And I had this diversified portfolio in, you know, 2009. And then I just kept going. I kept pushing more and more chips into a smaller and smaller pile. And that became Drip. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon it was like, okay, so now I have a podcast with Mike and MicroConf and Drip, and all of my net worth, aside from like, you know, some retirement savings, is literally stacked in this business that if I sold it, it's enough money that I don't have to work again. But it made me nervous. It made me nervous, especially with, you know, there are things, I mean, when you're running an ESP, it's like, Russian spammers get in one night and they send things and it burns all your IPs and they all get blacklisted, and then SendGrid or your other provider calls and says, oh, we're going to shut down your account. And you think to yourself, wow, this it never did. This could go to zero tomorrow in a big way. Mm. Or the competition. I mean, I don't need to list off the number of ESPs. You and I could probably name 15 off the top of our head, and there were hundreds more. And I was like, well, what if these guys take my market share? What if we can't keep up? What if the servers go down? What if we can't scale this thing? Which eventually we did run into scaling issues after we sold. And it would have been really, really hard to overcome those, I think, without either a lot of money to hire developers, or, as you know, after we sold, they of course had venture capital and were able to fix them. So there were other factors than just, you know, not enjoying the job day to day. And I did enjoy, it's not like I didn't enjoy the thing the whole time. I mean, it was 2.5 years from like when Derek and I started it to when I got the first email about, not really the first, but it was the first kind of viable email of like, hey, we want to acquire you. And then it was another year, 12, 13 months after that, you know, till it sold. So it was about 3.5 years in. And I'm not saying I think part of the part, you know, when I think back, you know, your memory's fuzzy, like part of it is that I was dealing with an acquisition during the last 6 months. And so I was burning out even more. And so that kind of taints my memory of things. Cause I know that there were times in 2015 that were just fine, but it was on and off. So yeah, there were definitely more factors than just not enjoying it.
Yeah. I guess kind of going back to my original thought around this, and I'm sorry I got us derailed a little bit there, but like, what if you didn't sell, right? So the options are to sell, to raise a bunch of money, and kind of in that way fund the trajectory of growth that you want, or, you know, kind of flip it back to a bootstrap lifestyle business, and not in a negative way, in that, like, it's not a negative connotation. What do you think those paths could have looked like? And the reason I ask is I think there's probably people out there who are at this point of saying like, it's about time to do something with this, right? And you have like these three options. One is just kind of let it run. One is to raise a bunch of money and really try to go for something big. And the other is, you know, I probably need to start aligning with somebody to get acquired or partner or merge or whatever.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing about acquisitions. What I had heard, and I'll assume this is true, I don't know, is that, hey, once you get, there's kind of this window to sell your business where there's acquirers like a Lead Pages where they can pay X millions of dollars. But if you double or triple in size, the multiple, they can no longer afford you. And so I heard there was this valley that once you crossed it, you had to get to the other side now. So then it's like, okay, we got to do this for another 2, 3, 4 years to get to the other side where now people have the money. So that was another factor that I wanted to throw in. So given that we did, you know, you basically said, keep bootstrapping, raise money, sell, right? Those are the options. So we did sell, you know, so we probably don't need to talk through that one. I think the bootstrapping route I would have had to figure out, you know, how to hire an ops person because I was doing too much crap that I didn't want to do and too stressed out all the time. And that one's tough to think about because I was already of the mindset by the time we started getting emails, hey, we want to acquire you. We had already talked several times about raising an angel round. And, you know, I don't know what the valuation could have been. I'm guessing 10 or 15 million based on our revenue and, you know, could have raised whatever, $1 million. Now, the thing that I kept struggling with that was I didn't want to raise venture capital because I don't think that's the route any of us, you know, in this community really are that interested in. And I didn't want to saddle myself to needing to exit at $100 million or whatever it winds up being. So it really was like looking to get an angel round and it was going to be more of the kind of, customer.io model, right? The fund strap model that I used to talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. And they were the first one that I said to do that in 2014. Or maybe they did it in 2013 and just started talking. I heard about it in 2014. And that was really what I was exploring. But I got to be honest, it's laughable today for me to say this, but like I didn't really know how to do that very well. And it felt like a ton of work and it felt like more complexity than I would have liked.
Sure.
In retrospect, I actually think I could have emailed the people in my network, you know, the former MicroConf speaker, just the people, you know, that I know, the founders and the whatevers, and probably raise that round pretty quickly with knowing what I know now. I think it wouldn't have been that hard to do. And I think raising $500,000 to $1 million at that point would have alleviated so much stress. And, you know, once we got acquired, then we had a lot of money in the business, right? Because Lead Pages had raised $38 million in venture. And I saw the difference that made. So now looking back, I think, I actually do see how I would have done things differently. And maybe that's with the virtue of hindsight, because once we got in Lead Pages, they do this stuff so differently. Like they hire senior people and they have a full-time recruiter on staff so that, you know, the developer managers don't have to do that. And that, you know, they have specialists instead of these generalists and on and on and on. They just did stuff so differently than what we were doing. And they do it for a reason.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. I mean, something that I've seen you talking about at the very beginning, kind of self-funding with, you know, a significant amount of money to really get off the ground. And I think we hear this from other people, you know, oh, I didn't pull any money out of the business, or I didn't pay myself until we were at, you know, 30K MRR or something like that. And that, like, to me, that or like I did, like I didn't take a salary from Castos for the first year, probably because they had Podcast Motor running on the side or consultants or whatever. And I think a lot of people who are just starting out think like, I'm going to like honestly bootstrap this thing and not take money from somewhere else. And that's a fallacy. Cause I mean, the money has to come from somewhere. You can't just decide today, I'm going to start a SaaS and make any money in the first year. at least. And I think 2 years before you really are getting somewhere. And I do think that as you get bigger, it kind of comes around again to say like, okay, we're at this point, you know, 30, 50, 100K or whatever. To get to that next point, something else has to change is just what I'm hearing from kind of being in the space is like, yeah, what got me here isn't going to get me there, like to that big next level. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't say across the board. Obviously, we see companies bootstrap to, we can name five examples of companies that bootstrap to 20 million or 100 million or more in revenue. So it's definitely possible. Yeah. I do think it needs a certain confluence of events. I talk about hard work, luck, and skill. I do think there's definitely skill involved and there's definitely a lot of hard work, but I also think there's a notch of luck in there that maybe people don't see if they're not on the inside to become a Basecamp or a MailChimp, you know? So yeah, I think and then there's also this whole other type of app. Like I had Hittail at one point doing 30K MRR and it was just me and a couple contractors. Well, that thing threw off cash like ridiculous, you know, I don't 25 grand a month in like net profit or something. So there are apps like that. So don't think that in order to grow that, you have to take it, you know, raise funding or maybe, you know, that Hittail really wasn't going to become a next level app, right? The space just wasn't that big. The need for it wasn't that big. But if you are in a pretty hyper-competitive space or a space that is growing quickly and your app is growing quickly, then there does come a time where your growth will be hindered by the lack of available capital. It's just a fact. And you will have to decide if you are interested in, you know, in capturing that growth. And that's really it. And if you do, then you want to raise some money and pump that into growth. This is not raising to build a social network. You know, this is not raising before you have a product that's a huge gamble. This is raising on a B2B SaaS app that's, let's say, doing $500,000 or $1 million a year, where you probably have several proven acquisition channels. And it is literally like pumping $1 into a slot machine and getting $1.50 or $2 back every crank of the handle. That's how I think about a SaaS at that point. It's so predictable and so repeatable. And if you're not there and you're kind of fumbling along, well, then I personally wouldn't do it at that point, right? It's when you're still trying to find those channels, you know, I would say, well, you haven't reached escape velocity yet. And so don't raise. But yeah, that's I guess how I think about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, again, like people email me or tweet at me about Tiny Seed and asking, you know, hey, you know, should I join or I'm doing this? What do you think? And I say, like, there were people in batch one that were kind of like pre-product or pre-revenue. And to me, yeah, that's quite a different risk profile to like take money, join this accelerator, quit your job, go do this thing before you know really if you have something, than, you know, kind of like where we were and some other companies where like we have something, this will help us accelerate that growth. It's a little more certain. Sure, we probably gave up relatively more than the person that, I don't want to say they had nothing to lose, but had, you know, kind of less to lose. Like the amount of kind of equity we gave up is different than somebody who's, you know, pre-product and pre-revenue. But yeah, that kind of fit my risk appetite more. I think taking money before you are really off the ground is kind of a gamble, I guess.
Yeah, it's a different approach. And I will say that like the amount of money I was talking about raising for Drip, $500,000 to $1 million, is very different than an accelerator, you know, raising 120K.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But
yeah,
to your point, you're right. There's
I'm still playing Little League over here.
No, totally. But yeah, and that's a thing. Like in batch two, we didn't have any pre-revenue companies. And just pre-revenue is just so much harder and it always takes so much longer, even if you're a second time founder. I think all of the pre-revenue companies in batch, they all were second or third time founders, most of them with exits actually, you know, so that was in those cases we were betting on founders rather than, you know, than the product, but you're right. It takes a long time to get there. And it's I want to be clear too. I've been saying this stance since I wrote my book in 2009. So it's not like, oh, I run Tiny Seed now. I'm suddenly suggesting bootstrappers should raise money. No. 2009, 2010, I was like, hey, there comes a time where you should at least consider it, you know? And it's not the right path for everybody, but I do know that it fixes a lot of things. Even there's the don't knows, the unknowns that you don't know, and there's funding can fix shocking amounts of those things.
Yeah. I'd love to kind of close out, and I'm going to put you on the spot big time here, because I would guess you haven't thought about this too much, but after seeing, you know, 10 companies go through batch one of Tiny Seed, and now seeing these other, what is it, 9 or 10 companies in batch two?
13.
Oh my gosh. Yep. 13 companies in batch two. I know you've talked about like pattern matching, like the things that people struggle with and the people that companies are successful with. I would love to see, like, with the advent of batch two and what you know of those companies so far, some things that you can generalize that you're seeing that is really working well.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a good question.
Positions they're in or...
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, like the biggest lever of all, and it's what we did. We're doing something slightly different with batch two, where we saw that the things people were struggling with in batch one, and we're kind of taking a 30-minute slide deck and saying, like, this is kind of our stance, or at least our recommendation on how you should think about this. And so we've picked some topics that were pretty common with across batch one and batch two, actually, as we had conversations. So like the big lever is pricing, right? So what's not working is when people price too low, or the value metric is off, or they don't tier it correctly, or they don't charge a lot to their enterprise customers. And what does work is when they fix all those things, and you can double your growth, triple your growth, literally by changing a number on your website, you know? So, hey, my cheapest plan was 19 and suddenly it's 99 and I got the same number of conversions. And we are seeing stuff like that. So pricing's a huge lever. There's kind of two types of companies. It's a very generalization. It's a binary look at it. But like, you know, there's the high volume, low touch, lower cost SaaS apps. Like I put Castos in that bucket, mm-hmm. right? Where it's $19 mm-hmm. a month entry level. And then there are the, you know, higher priced enterprise sales, long sales cycles, but you don't need to land very many customers to grow quickly. And that's like in batch one, there Riembi is riembi.com, where I think the lowest prices were like $500 a month. And so you only need two customers a month, you know, two new customers a month in order to match 500. Is that right? No, 50 new customers of Castos, yep. right, to match the MRR. So you need a very much wider funnel. And Riembi just has those long sales cycles. So they need a lot of people coming through the pipeline. It's all very high touch and they're doing contracts. The companies that I'm seeing growing the fastest have both. They have this really wide funnel and a lot of exposure and thousands of customers paying them not very much money. But then they have on the flip side, they also have enterprise customers saying, oh, we need this tool too. And they get charged, you know, 10 times, 100, 50, 100 times more than the entry-level folks. Mm. Yeah, but they have both an enterprise funnel and a low-touch funnel. And I don't want to, there are several in batch two. And I'm trying to even think of like an example of like WooFoo. Do you remember WooFoo? WUFO.com. Yeah, yeah. I believe it was a Y Combinator company. It was like kind of like Typeform before Typeform, something mm-hmm. that like you could build forms and stuff. When they sold, one of the founders said it was some, like, don't quote me on the number, but it was like 85, like they were $10 a month, $20 a month, freemium, that whole thing, right? But they said, yeah, 85% of our revenue came from like the biggest 10% of our customers. That was where all their revenue came
really?
From. Really? Yeah, the vast majority. And because they had that dual funnel that I'm talking about, you know, where you have the high touch and the low touch mixed. It's really interesting. So that's something that, and you know, we saw that at Drip too, right? I mean, I guess our bottom end was 49 for a while. And then we had the $1 plan and the free plan and all that. But then we had customers come in and saying, hey, I have a million subscribers, literally, and I'm going to pay you however much that is, $1,000 a month. And those really started moving the needle the more of those we got. And so while we still had 300 trials, 500 trials, 1,000 trials a month, whatever the numbers were at the time, they were both kind of growing in tandem. And without the enterprise, the growth wouldn't have been as fast. So sorry, that was a longer answer.
With respect to... No, that's super interesting. Like, I'm fascinated from a pricing and like value metric perspective. Are the companies in batch two doing different things, or kind of like engineering that kind of barbell, right? So where you have like a bunch of people paying you $20 a month and you have some people paying you $500 a month, did they have to, you know, rearrange, you know, an enterprise offering or figure out how to price it? You know, is it like per seat or per... whatever license, right? I mean, but yeah, what, like, yeah, are they doing things to engineer that, or is it just kind of serendipity happening?
No, typically you get approached by an enterprise customer and they look at your current pricing and they say, oh, we're, insert name of Fortune, let's say Target, because they're here in Minneapolis. And Target approaches you and says, hey, I want to buy, you know, your SaaS app. And it looks like we should pay $99 a month. Well, that's no, they should not be paying $99 a month. There are things they're going to need, like custom contracts, and they might need single sign-on. There are these really common things that these enterprises need. We want single sign-on, let's custom contracts. We want to be able to invoice with POs. We want to have integration with, you know, Salesforce or with big ERP system. Like any of these things, the moment that these should be trigger words in your head of like, they should pay 50 times what our normal customers do. Because it's going to be a 6-month sales cycle. There's going to be security audits. I may need some type of ISO certification. I'm going to need to go through procurement. Instantly, that's why they should pay more. You're not ripping them off. It literally is a pain. It's that much more of a pain in the ass. It's the pain in the ass, a premium to deal with larger companies, and they can afford it and they will get the value out of it, you know? So oftentimes that's what it is. So you do engineer it, but usually, you know, usually, I mean, there's examples of this. Like look at, you know, Tuple, Ben Ornstein's company, like look at their pricing. Yeah, yeah. They basically have, I think it's $25 per seat, or the moment you want single sign-on, custom stuff, a lot of the stuff I just named, which we're seeing in the batch as well, then it's, you know, it's double the price or something like that. And frankly, it should probably be more than that. But you know, it is what, I guess if they had, but it's also per seat. So that actually,
I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, that was something that I was kind of trying to get at and think about is like, are these big ticket customers, like you mentioned, like at Drip, 1 million subscribers, like that's just usage based, you know, or Tuple is per seat. Like for us, I guess it would be like downloads or bandwidth or something like that. Is like, I think about all this as kind of usage based plus all of that stuff, right? Like the single sign on and ISO and all that. So is that kind of it? Is that like, if you want to be in this bucket, if you're a heavy user, you get all, we will give you all of this stuff and you'll pay a premium for it. That is that kind of the recipe?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, you just need to call us on the right-hand side that has a few things that you don't include in any of your other tiers. And like you're saying, usage-based or value metric, those are equivalent things, right? You have a metric where they get more value, like subscribers, you know, or podcast downloads. That will go up linearly often. But if you, once there are certain features that people need, that implies, you know, they're a different type of consumer. I mean, an example in podcasting is like, there are, I'm sure with Castos, you have people doing like fly fishing podcasts, you know, or comic book podcasts or whatever. And they are super price sensitive because it's a hobby and they probably will never make money from it. So to them, $10-$20 a month is actually a substantial investment. Then there's you, let's say you and I, you know, Startups for the Rest of Us, Tiny Seed Tales, Rogue Startups, and your audience podcast. Like $20 is nothing. So for us. So like, would I be willing to pay $50 to $100 for my podcast hosting as long as I got more stuff out of it? Features mostly? Yeah. Or bandwidth or whatever? Yeah, I would. I mean, that's where my price sensitivity goes. And then if Gimlet Media approached you, should they pay $50 or $100? No, they should pay you $1,000 or $5,000 or some substantially higher number. And a lot of companies, so those are just three buckets, and every business won't have three buckets, but that's the thought exercise you go through is like, I should at least have two buckets, but oftentimes there's like three or four. And that's where you have the hobbyist plan and the pro plan and the enterprise plan. You know, they almost name themselves because you and I are pros, you know, or maybe it's hobbyist business and enterprise or something like that. But it once you understand your business and you see how people are using it, it does become easier. It's not a custom thought process each time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. We've kind of backed into that with a couple of people that are really have really heavy usage, and they have hundreds of thousands of listens a month, and we get them on the phone pretty quick after that happens for a month, and you say, yo, you know, we have acceptable terms or acceptable use terms in our, you know, terms and conditions, and like, this is just not acceptable. Like, this is not normal. And we have conversations, we've had it, I don't know, a dozen times, and every time they're like, yeah, I've been, you know, waiting for this call.
Totally.
Absolutely happy to pay, you know, pretty much whatever. And we've got a couple of different, you know, kind of relative prices on those, but the conversation always goes really smooth. It's amazing. Yeah.
So much.
Yeah. We should advertise it more, I guess.
Totally.
Right. No. And they're all huge, huge businesses or podcast networks or whatever, to where $500 a month is, you know, for the biggest top of funnel marketing asset they have is nothing, you know?
Not that big. And they have they probably have some different needs too. They could probably use like multi-user login and roles, so that like a producer has a different role than an editor, than the talent. And, you know, and you would never build that for your fly fishing guy and, so, you know, fly fishing podcaster. Yep. And so that's the kind of thinking that goes into it, is like, yeah, what do they really need? And oftentimes the good news is they'll probably tell you, you know, they'll tell you what they need, which helps.
Yep. 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 Cool, man. This is a lot of fun to catch up. Yeah, for folks who want to check out the podcast, obviously, startupsfortherestofus.com. Rob, on Twitter, you are?
I'm at Rob Walling. And if folks are interested, if you don't mind me mentioning this, Tiny Seed, you know, we invest in B2B SaaS companies, and we are currently raising our second fund. And so if you are an accredited investor and you're interested in like diversifying some funds across a lot of high quality, you know, B2B SaaS companies, much like Castos, you know, you can look at batch one and batch two at tinyseed.com. You can head to tinyseed.com/invest if you're interested in finding out more about what that looks like.
Awesome. A lot of fun, Rob. Thanks.
Absolutely, man. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.